For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Independent journalist Dar Jamail has been reporting from Iraq. He joins us to talk about his work there now that he's back in the States. Dar Jamail, you're just back from Iraq. Tell me, first of all, what the reaction has been of people in the media here versus what you were getting used to in Iraq.
Well, thanks, Dori. It basically is similar as to when I left. We're not really getting the full story of how the occupation is affecting the Iraqi people and what's going on in Iraq as far as rebuilding and the liberation that we heard talked about so much before the invasion. And the one thing that is coming out, though, is the situation is so terrible and continuing to degrade that we are starting to see, things are not going as planned. This war is not paying for itself. The rebuilding, maybe it isn't going exactly as planned. So that part is good. And actually that is somewhat hopeful for me, that people are starting to get the idea that basically this is just one huge giant quagmire, and that is starting to come out.
While you were over there, the U.S. and the Bush administration went back to the U.N. for assistance, if you will, and to start their policy over again. Did you see any change when that took place?
No, that hasn't affected anything in Iraq. Just before I left was when they were sending in the U.N. inspection team for the election situation and basically ramping up for that. It just caused more bloodshed, because there was many more suicide bombings, many more attacks on Iraqi police, and things of this nature. So if anything, the one thing that has been consistent is every political move that the U.S. makes basically just brings more bloodshed in Iraq. Even with this election situation and them sending in the U.N., people in Iraq, even the people that aren't as educated as some, they know what's going on, and they've lived in this situation for a long time now, and they're very astute, and they see these little political maneuverings that are being done, and that basically in the end they know that it's not going to help them at all. It's just rhetoric, and so this is basically what's been going on the ground there.
We've had just Tuesday, the 10th of February, yet another bombing, a car bombing in Iraq that has apparently taken the lives of 50 people or more. It's not clear at just how bad the damage is, but there's a lot of injuries. Dar, when you were in Iraq, there was the bombing of the coalition headquarters that took the lives of 31 people or more. Tell me what it's like on a day when that happens. What is the climate? How does the U.S. military and the Coalition Provisional Authority react? What kinds of things go on under these conditions?
Well, it's always an extremely tense and very hopeless feeling that pervades. I've been there during several of the really huge bombings, particularly the one at the CPA, the one at the restaurant on New Year's Eve. And everyone has, like, stone faces. Most of the people, the people in my hotel or people out on the street or people in restaurants or taxi drivers, everyone is just, there's this feeling of hopelessness and despair. And rather than showing overt emotion, it kind of comes out as people just have these stone, solemn faces, kind of just this hopelessness, and people are numb. There's so much of this has gone on there, during the 91 Gulf War, the sanctions, Saddam, the recent invasion, and then now this. People are just kind of numb to it, and I don't mean like they don't pay attention or it doesn't affect them. It's just that's the feeling. And then the U.S. reaction of just more of the same, it's basically just spewing more rhetoric about, we'll increase the security, or we will go after the people responsible for this, blah, blah, blah. That has no effect other than to just increase the hopelessness, because people in Iraq have seen this thousands and thousands of times. And here is another invading country that is saying the same thing that all of the others have said, and there's no follow-through. And when they do attempt to make change, it usually just results in more bloodshed and more anarchy. So that it's really intense when these happen. The bombs are so large that even being miles away, For example, the CPA, when it was hit, I was in a hotel about 2 miles from there, and you feel it. They're so powerful that it's like a small earthquake. You feel it in the floor, the rattles of the windows rattle in the room where you are, and everyone knows exactly what has happened because, you know, they're even larger than when an IED goes off and hits a patrol, and everyone knows, and there's this immediate sense of loss because you know that lots of people have died because that was such a huge explosion, and, you know, it's always innocent people that are killed as well as whoever was targeted. So it's just this terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach, like, oh, my God, you know, here it goes again.
Dar, you, in your time in Iraq, reported on a lot of violence going on that took the lives of civilian Iraqis. And as you know, we did have locally here in West Hartford, Connecticut, a town forum event that took place. There were two speakers, former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter and Middle East expert Rahul Mahajan. Both of these gentlemen talked about the failure of U.S. foreign policy and the absolute despair in the world over U.S. foreign policy, and then some of what we might be able to do about it. And we're going to be discussing that event together here now that you're home and you've just been in Iraq. Rahul Mahajan had been in Iraq in January, so it was a fascinating discussion. And one of the things that I want to say first, though, is that you had sent home some reports about security in Iraq and the lack of security in Iraq and at borders, the lack of security in general that you were seeing. And this is something that Rahul Mahajan also referred to, in fact, saying that he had a harder time crossing the border from Canada to the United States than he did crossing the border into Iraq.
There is no security at the border, despite all the rhetoric that we're being told here in America by the Bush administration and their media mouthpieces. There is no security. There was not one U.S. soldier at the border when I came in or when I left. I was never searched. My bags were never searched. Our car was never searched. It was a GMC vehicle, never searched. So there's no security at the border whatsoever. They talk about, yes, we're working to, you know, bring security to the Iraqi people and to our troops there, but the border is wide open, and then you have George Bush saying, bring them on. It brings up ideas of deep, dark conspiracy theories of, like, well, let's welcome all the terrorists to Iraq so that way we don't have to fight them at home. It'll just be at the cost of our own U.S. soldiers and the Iraqi civilians. But that's the security situation at the border, is that there basically is none. The border, at least with Jordan, is wide open. And everyone else I spoke with had the exact same experience in the entire 9 weeks that I was there. Anytime I saw someone new, I'd say, hey, well, what's going on at the border? You know, wondering if they'd finally put soldiers there or not. And everyone's like, oh, it was no problem. Yeah, we just cruise right through it. I mean, you go in, get the stamp in your passport, hop back in your car. I mean, it takes time because of the lines, but that's essentially the situation.
We're going to take a moment now to listen as Rahul Mahajan describes his January visit to the Iraqi chief of police.
So one day we decided to go and have an audience with the Baghdad chief of police. Now, nominally, you expect the chief of police of a large city is a somewhat important person. I was amazed, you know, who the hell do they think they are just saying we're going to go and walk in and interview the chief of police? Doesn't he have better things to do? We're just a bunch of random activists from the United States. But no problem. We got in. Interestingly enough, when we got in, you remember the Iraqi police is often under attack, and sometimes it's even from the resistance. It's about half and half from the U.S. military and the resistance, but they're under fire from everyone. There was no metal detectors, and we were not frisked. When we walked into the office of the chief of police without ever being checked for weapons. That's how important the chief of police is. So we walk in. There's not a single piece of paper on his desk. There was a computer way in the back, but it was clearly for show. It wasn't turned on. We asked him questions like, what's your budget? He said, I don't know. So this man has nothing to do. He doesn't know what's going on. He has nothing better to do than sit around for an hour answering our questions, and then we terminated the interview, not him. And this is a standard pattern. You want to talk to American officials in Iraq? No chance. They don't have time for you. They're very busy. They have a lot of work to do. Maybe you'll squeeze in 2 minutes somewhere, but probably not. Iraqi officials and the Iraqi government, no problem. Sit, chat for a couple hours, have tea. The entire Iraqi government is basically being given almost nothing to do.
Characterize the police and comment, if you can, on what Raul Mahajan is saying here. It sounds like what he's saying is that it's just a kind of a puppet force that has no power in the nation at all.
Well, that's exactly right. Basically, the Iraqi police, they are a micro version of what American policy is doing in the entire country. It's this rushed, not well thought out policy, and they're just basically trying to take warm bodies and put them out there as sort of puppets. And their training period, for example, is 18 days, I believe. Most of them are quite young. They're basically young kids. Most of them don't even need to shave yet, walking around with Kalashnikovs on the street with like an armband, maybe a blue shirt if they're lucky. This is the Iraqi police. Many of them are resistance fighters, and they're just doing it for information for the resistance. And they basically have no power, and they know it. The only power they do have is the fact that they can walk around on the street with a gun. I've personally seen justice meted out on the street. I was walking down the street one day, and I saw a man yanked from his car, thrown on the ground, beaten, hit in the head with the butt of a rifle, and then lay there, this crumpled mass bleeding on the sidewalk. I walked up, what's going on? What's happening here? He's a thief. He's a thief. And then they just left, and they left the man on the ground. And I've actually seen this situation more than once. And this is justice in Iraq. And this is how the training of the Iraqi police force there. I mean, can you imagine if that were the case here in America? What would people do? How would people react? How do you think that makes Iraqis feel? Most people also believe that I have a friend, he's saying, you know, this is worse than Saddam. Under Saddam, the Ba'athists didn't even behave this way. In addition, the Iraqi police, most of them are Ba'athists. And so it's another situation where the Americans came in, did this big purge, we have to do deep Ba'athification, get rid of all the Ba'athists. And the fact of the matter is they've been forced, because of their own policies, to rehire many of the Ba'athists as Iraqi police.
They're going to change the war zone and pull out U.S. personnel from Baghdad and other parts of the country so that what will then happen is that the Iraqi police forces will have to take care of the security in these regions. Tell me what kind of image you get of that possibility.
It's going to be an absolute debacle. This is a political move. They're basically doing it to try to minimize U.S. casualties in the lead up to the election, and also they're trying to emulate what the British have done in Basra. This is the policy that the British were doing in Basra all along, is they had no camps in Basra. They stayed on the perimeter, and they just ran patrols during the day. And so now they're finally trying to follow suit in Baghdad. The problem is while this was effective for the Brits down in Basra for a long time, they've been taking more and more hits. And they've been just as stealthy as the Americans as far as reporting them or having them buried a bit further down in the newspapers, but they're actually taking more and more casualties in the South as well. So it's a policy that maybe it was effective at the beginning, but it's starting to fail as well. And then the idea of leaving it to the Iraqi police, as you've probably read, and some of this has come out even in the mainstream, even a couple of days ago, there was a high-ranking Iraqi policeman who was caught carrying out attacks on U.S. patrols. So the fact is a lot of the resistance fighters are joining the Iraqi police to get the free training as well as to learn the tactics and get intelligence on the Americans. So, and then the rest of the Iraqi police, the legitimate policemen, they're being run through with, like, I think it's 14 to 18 days of training, and then they're put out as an Iraqi police, and they're basically just kids walking around with Kalashnikovs in the streets, many of them 18, 19 years old. And this is the Iraqi police force. They basically have no power. They're being used as human shields by the military. I've seen it with my own eyes. When they walk a patrol through Samarra, for example, there'll be a U.S. patrol walking down the street following a Humvee or a Bradley fighting vehicle, and then soldiers walking down the street, and then between the soldiers and then the people on the sidewalk are the Iraqi police. I mean, literally using them as human shields. I've seen this time and time again, and they use them similarly in Baghdad as well. And as we see with this terrible bombing yet again, the Iraqi police are being hit by the resistance because they're collaborating with the Americans. And these people, you know, so many of them are innocent, and they're just doing this. They need the money desperately. They're trying to put food on their families' plates, but because they're collaborating with the Americans, they're being targeted, and they're far softer targets than the Americans, and they're going to be the ones to pay the price of the Americans pulling out of Baghdad. They're going to be the ones that are going to be bombed on an even more intense basis now. So it's really a terrible situation. I mean, if this indeed succeeds in with the Americans pulling out of Baghdad and other cities, if this does indeed bring about a drop in the number of attacks on Americans and American casualties, it's going to mean far more attacks and casualties on Iraqi police and therefore, of course, the civilian bystanders when these huge bombings occur.
You know, another thing that listeners of this station would have heard when we broadcast the full text of Rahul Mahajan's speech in West Hartford was this idea that the country has no leadership, has no government. What do you think the chances are that if the United States were to focus on turning power over, that that would work under these circumstances?
Well, there really essentially is none. In fact, the CPA is kind of the civilian arm of the military operations in Iraq, and you can't call it a government, but it's what there is that most closely resembles government in Iraq now. The IGC, the Iraqi Governing Council, which is all 100% U.S. appointed, everyone in Iraq I spoke with, regardless of whether they're Arab, Turkmen, Sunni, Shia, Kurdish, every single person said, the first chance we get, the IGC is going to be smashed. They're not Iraqi. They're exiles. They haven't been in Iraq. We didn't elect them. They're appointed. They're not legitimate. We will smash them the first chance that we get. So this is basically what will happen. The only thing that people are in agreement on is, yes, we want some sort of legitimate, transparent, democratic election. And at the same time, they're not naive enough to believe that this will happen. The promise is for this summer, and that's why this summer is going to be a very intense time in Iraq, because that's when it was supposed to take place. And when it doesn't, people are going to react. And people, it will have been well over a year by then. There will still be no infrastructure. The heat will be on, and literally and figuratively, and people are going to be desperate for change by then. And there isn't going to be any government put in place that's even quasi-legitimate to make that happen.
And what you're saying now that is that the Baathists are in control of the police. That's who our Secretary of Defense wants to leave the security to. The United States has apparently been largely arresting and targeting Sunnis. It sounds definitely like there's a provocation to civil war here. Talk a little bit about that.
I would agree again. As far as the divisions that are occurring, I know that Iraq, for example, always every 10 years they carry it out a nationwide census. And in this census, you know, check if you're male or female, you know, what's your age, et cetera, et cetera. And then under the religion section, it had Muslim, Christian, you know, Hindu, Jew, whatever, check one. It didn't have Muslim and then, okay, check whether you're Shia or Sunni. There was no distinction. So that raises the question of where do we even get this 60% Shia statistic? Many Iraqis feel that it's a completely American-generated thing right along the lines of exactly what you're just talking about. Like, where did this come from? This is a relatively new thing. In fact, if someone had showed up in Iraq just a couple of years ago and started asking people whether they're Sunni or Shia, that's actually considered very rude. People would look at them like, you know, what are you doing? I'm Muslim, you know, and that's how that is viewed. And so it's definitely another one step of many along the line of moving towards trying to divide Iraq. And I think, you know, making the argument that it's an intentional sort of segregation and divisions that are being formed within the country for this is a very legitimate argument. And it's, that is extremely worrisome. But so many of the things that we're seeing borne out on the ground are, seem to be pointing in that direction.
Now, as things stand right now, Dar, the United States is pulling out of some zones, holding on to others. There's talk of the building of U.S. military bases. There's talk of the continuation of the U.S. control of the Iraqi oil fields. How would that, you know, in your view, how would that look? And what kind of policy would that be on the part of the U.S., that kind of a partial occupation while leaving large portions of Iraq to the Iraqis to run by themselves?
Well, how can it possibly work? Everyone knows that, and most of the Iraqis I spoke with know that the Americans are there to stay. Most people said, yes, we want them out. We don't want them out right now. We know it would plunge the country into complete anarchy and probably immediate civil war. So we don't want them to leave now, but we want them out, and depending on who you talk to, it's either 6 months, a year, or 5 years. But the fact is those bases are there to stay. As long as this administration and the project for the New American Century continues to be enacted, they're there forever, and many people know that as well. And so the idea of having bases and then basically controlling the oil and then leaving the rest of Iraq to Iraqis, how is that possibly going to work? My opinion is, and based on everyone that I spoke with, regardless Shia, Sunni, whatever, everyone feels that as long as the Americans are in Iraq, because the invasion was illegal and because now the subsequent occupation is illegal, they're going to keep getting hit. The resistance, you know, maybe it won't turn into a full-fledged war, but it's going to just continue this low-grade, grinding guerrilla war. And it's going to continue as long as the Americans are there, whether they have 60 bases in Baghdad, 5, 1, or none. They're going to continue to get hit. And already the bases that they do have that are not in cities, like, for example, those on the outskirts of Fallujah or Balad or Bakuba, those get hit. Those get hit on almost a weekly basis by mortars and rockets. There was actually one, I think, less than a week ago where even a couple of U.S. soldiers were killed and many more were wounded by a rocket attack. And that base, if I believe that I'm correct, wasn't even in a city. So this is just a foreshadowing of what will happen. It basically, my point is, it doesn't matter where they are, the resistance is going to continue.
You know, it occurs to me that as the United States shifts its policy in Iraq and tries to put some of the burden onto the UN and Iraqi police forces there, and also has invited new troops in from places like South Korea, as this change takes place, what do you think might happen to all of the Iraqis that were arrested in these house-to-house searches that President George W. Bush cited as one of his great successes in this region, that they were making arrests in Iraq?
I saw even just the other day with Japan sending in their troops that they had to evacuate their embassy because of bomb threats. And they're going to continue to get hit, just like the Italians were and the Spanish. And these terrible things will continue to happen to them as well. So this is going to be an ongoing situation. And as far as the effect of detaining people and Mr. Bush being proud of that, all that's doing is making the resistance grow, because basically the policy is whenever there's attacks on Americans is they go in and detain. They'll seal off a one square block area of where the patrol is hit, if it's in Baghdad, for example, and then they'll just go in and yank all the older men out of any house or store nearby. And so, yes, you may get one or two people who've been responsible for the attack, but you're also getting 80 or 90% of the people that are being rounded up are totally innocent. But then, as Arab culture dictates, as do probably our own, people are going to want justice, and a lot of people are going to want revenge. And so that's how the resistance is growing, is these people are being detained, they're being put in these prisons, their family can't contact them. Half the time they don't even know where they are, and then there's no compensation. And there's, you know, who are they going to complain to but the people that did it? So there's no justice. I mean, that's what we have going on in Iraq, is a situation where like a good friend of mine told me, there's all this power in zero justice. And all it's doing is infuriating people and causing more anarchy and more people to turn against them. That's the result of the heavy-handed tactics, and that's the result of all these mass detentions that Mr. Bush is so proud of.
What I want to do now, Dar, is just take a listen to some of what went on in West Hartford as members of the audience were able to ask Scott Ritter and Rahul Mahajan some questions.
Thank you. My name is Dave Yano. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I direct this towards you, Scott, but can you and will you support the GI resistance within the ranks to this war in Iraq?
I'll answer this from the perspective of a Marine Corps officer. And look, when I grew up as a kid, my dad taught me one thing, that if you're going to break the rules, be willing to accept the consequences. I believe that every American needs to make their own decision about how they feel about war, peace, military service. If you sign up for the military, you incur a certain obligation. If the war that you're asked to fight you find to be morally reprehensible and unsupportable, I think you have a duty as a citizen to say, I will not participate. However, in so doing, you also have to have the ability to stand up and say, now put me in jail. Because you can't undertake a courageous action that doesn't have repercussions. I mean, everybody can be a hero if charging a machine gun nest never resulted in your body getting stitched with the bullets. These people who resist, these military resistors, in this time of this unjust war in Iraq, I view as heroes, but their actions are only heroic if they're willing to pay the consequence, and that means that they must stand up and say, I will not obey this because this is unjust. Now punish me. And then the American people need to rally around them and say, not too severely.
Dar Jamail, you saw a lot of U.S. military personnel in Iraq and how they were handling this horrible quagmire over there and what's gone wrong. What do you think about what Scott Ritter just said?
I think it's fantastic what he said, and I think that is the only hope for the change. I have done the candlelight vigils myself. I've done the demonstrations, the marches, calling the senators, calling my congressmen, writing the letters, informing people, trying to get news out. I've done all that, and I think right now we are at a point where all that's well and good and necessary, but it's time for direct action. And I think massive civil disobedience is really the only thing that's going to affect change at this point. And some of the most effective CD that we could see would be within the military. Bulgarian soldiers have been doing it. We've seen it happening in Israel. And it needs to start happening with American soldiers, where people basically say, this is unconscionable. I'm not going to pick up my gun for this because I don't believe in it, because the whole thing's a lie. And this is what we need to have happen, both with the soldiers, as well as going straight for the heart of the matter, which is doing our best to shut down the corporations that have caused this entire thing to happen, Halliburton and the Bechtels. And then it's time for direct action. And direct, nonviolent civil disobedience is the answer. And we've had a lot of practice in that historically, but it's been a long time since it's been practiced on a massive scale. And some of the most effective that could happen would be within the military. And then just as Mr. Ritter said, which is absolutely right on, is then we would need to support these people and support their families. Because most of the people in the military are poor, and that's why they go in, for the training and for funding and for hope for education. And then that would be an absolutely huge heroic act for someone to take who has a family and children to take care of, putting their entire livelihood at risk because they believe in the morality of what they're going to do, and then it would be up to us to support their family, whatever that looks like, financially, you know, materially, however, morally. So it's time. It's time for that. It's time, you know, for us to take the power that we have and basically start shutting down the system and saying, no, we're not going to run this anymore because it doesn't work and it's killing people and it's a crime. And at the same time, keep up the other things like the massive demonstrations and the protests and barraging our senators and congresspeople saying, why are you letting this happen? Where is the money? Where is the rebuilding in Iraq? Where is the support for the soldiers? where is the security that you've promised? You know, it's not happening. Why? And hold these people, write the letters to the editor, call them. I mean, I did both yesterday when I got home. It's like, why is the border situation wide open? Our soldiers are sitting ducks over there. Why are you letting this happen? Where is the $20 billion to be spent on reconstruction? Where is it? I was there. I didn't see any of it. There's no reconstruction. People are dying of cholera just like they did during the sanctions. So this is the sort of action that people can be taking now.
Dar Jamil, share with us some of the web pages where people can go to get better information about Iraq than from the mainstream press.
Electronic Iraq.net is they publish people who are there on the ground writing from the country. OccupationWatch.org is an international group that has a very strong presence in Baghdad, and they closely monitor detentions and home raids and the plight of the Iraqi people during this very difficult situation.
Thanks so much for joining us again on Regime Change Radio, Dar Jamil.
Thanks very much, Dory.
For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. If you would like further information on this broadcast, write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.